This is podcast number 626, and this week we will be discussing Daredevil Born Again, episodes 5 through 7, Adolescence, episodes 1 and 2, The Residence, episode 1 and 2, and The Wheel of Time, episodes 4 through 6. And if there's any of those shows that you don't want to be spoiled about, you can check out the time codes in the description below. And with that, let's get on with the show.
TV Campfire Podcast. We talk TV. Welcome to the show.
I'm your host, Libya, and I am a television and film editor, and we have returning guests.
Hey, this is Peter. I write for We Live Entertainment, and my handle, my social media is Pajamo.
Hi, this is Tom. I chair Visual and Media Arts at Palm Beach Atlantic University in Florida and host the Screen Time podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Hello, it's Malik Elamine. I'm managing director of Griot Theater.
All right, let's get on with the news. This week in the news, 1923 has ended or will be ending this season. And we will follow that up with what we had 1888, followed by 1883, followed by 1923, which will now be followed by 1944. Which, what happens when they catch up to Yellowstone time?
Is like, oh, the universe they have implodes. Plans to get there.
And we're getting this. I was about to say, the universe will then implode, and then you'll have a causality loop.
If you saw the double-sized finale yesterday, trust me, you know it ends, because we get the flash forward. And
oh, okay.
Yeah, I've said too much already, but yeah, it's you didn't have to tell people it was a series finale when you saw on the podcast
what happened. Okay.
Well, 1944 is just before World War II ends. It ends.
Yeah, 45.
April of 45.
Right. So I'm sure that's going to be a repercussion. We're going to have people coming back from war. Juno Temple has been cast as the lead in an A24 drama series, The Husbands, on Apple TV+. Dexter Original Sin has been renewed for season 2 at Showtime, which, by the way, that show started bad. For a while, I will say the first few episodes, I was very skeptical, and the only reason I kept watching was Sarah Michelle Gellar. However, by like episode 6 or 7 out of 10, or maybe even 5, I think it was episode 5 actually, they started an arc with this serial killer thing that actually had me completely engrossed and gripped, and I was into it, and I loved it all the way to the end, and it ended really well for season 1. So I did not expect to like this show at all, and I did. So there you go. I'm actually happy we got a season 2. actor Finn Jones wants the world to give him another shot at playing Iron Fist because he says he knows that the fans hated his performance and he wants to redeem himself. I say no. Just no. I do not want to give him a chance.
In his defense, I moderated a panel with him at Dragon Con before he got that gig when he was on Games of Thrones. He didn't write the show. It was not his decision to not give himself adequate martial arts training before starting the thing. So, I mean, when you consider the character is basically a privileged white boy, and he comes across as a privileged white boy. Oh, he's very gregarious and charming in real life, but if you get better writers for Iron Fist, he's not the problem.
No, the problem is he's not a leading man. Whether or not he can fight, that was a problem. I agree. But when I watch him, I don't feel compelled to watch him. There is nothing in his presence that makes me feel like I can't turn him off. So that is.
I thought he was okay. I lean more towards the story and the writing concerns, but we hear you, Olivia.
Yes. Give us Heroes for Hire. Prepare him with Mike Coulter, and Mike Coulter.
Yes, he can't be the lead. There you go.
He can carry the show, and Finn can tag along.
Lanterns has added Nathan Fillion as Guy Gardner to the surprise of no one. However, yeah. I'm very happy because I love Nathan Fillion, so I'm not going to be mad about that at all. I was already looking forward to the Lantern series, and this just adds to it because Nathan Fillion. So
I think it's awesome that both Kyle Chandler and why do I always forget his name? Aaron Pierre have green eyes naturally. So all you have to do is tweak them with special effects.
Just bring it up a little bit. Then let's move on to the shows. First up, we're going to talk Daredevil Born Again. And episode 5 is the bank robbery heist episode, which I did not expect. It's almost like a bottle episode in that.
Die Hard.
Yes. And it's very much, it has nothing. You're not really bringing any elements to the story into it. You're very much just like isolated inside this bank. And it's one location. And it's the definition of a bottle episode. But the whole time you're watching it, you're going, okay, when's he going to kill everybody? How is he going to get everybody in a dark corner and just take them all out?
I thought that putting Ms. Marvel's dad as one of the bank managers, and he and Matt have a lot of interaction. The Khan family in general is,
I love them.
Is genius. I mean, on TV, their part in Marvel's the movie was great, and pairing them with Matt was great. Kind of as in the Reginald Vell Johnson role of a Die Hard-esque episode.
I need to see their dinner because he invited him to dinner. I want to see Ms. Marvel have dinner with Daredevil. I think that would be adorable.
I agree. It was a standalone episode. It made me wonder, when did they promise the rest of the cast that they were going to get a little vacation time? It's like, we only need Daredevil. The rest of you, you know, go to Hawaii or something. That being said, you know, there's some things I liked and some things I didn't. I thought the first conversation with the bank manager was trying to be funny and wasn't. Once we got past that and we actually got to what was happening in the bank, I agree with you about their chemistry and their interactions was great. But the opening just left a lot to be desired to me. And Libya, you mentioned waiting for the fighting to happen. I loved the silent fight in the stairwell.
Oh, that was so good.
Because it's like, not only do I have to beat him, I have to make sure nobody can hear this fight. Mm-hmm. So
right.
That was pretty creative. I think this show in general does, we've talked about it, it does fights really well. And one of the ways they did fights well here was to create some obstacles to the fight that made it more than just, is he going to beat up the guy? So that was a lot of fun.
Well, it was also the head bank robber that kept getting into Matt's face and threatening him and pushing around a blind man. Like, why would you do that? Like, and he keeps putting a gun in
him. Evil.
Well, the thing that I thought was hilarious is he keeps putting a gun in Matt's face and he obviously can't see it. So what are you doing? Like, why are you trying to threaten him? He's like, see, do what I say with this gun that you can't see that I'm pointing at you.
He can smell the,
I know Matt can, metal. But he didn't know Matt could. So he looked dumb was my point. Is he was just like threatening him. I thought in a way that didn't make sense. So when Matt finally got to fight him, I felt like he had built up all this rage. So that fight in the street, in the hall. Well, also, before we get to that, I love the fact that they show how easily he can crack a bank safe, which meant he could have been a criminal at any point. He could have been robbing banks all day because he cracked that safe and like
he's a superhero.
I know, but it was just I know, but they just showing him how easily it was for him to rob that bank.
Unfortunately, that's another skill he cannot put on his resume.
Seriously.
So, yeah, but then the fight in the, once the robbery was over and the guy disguises himself as a cop and gets out, and you knew when he had that fight with the guy with the red mask that he was totally going to end up using that mask for later. And he just, but the way he beat that dude in the street felt like extra vicious. Like, I was like, what did he do to you?
But it also felt more difficult than it should have been. He had a hard time beating that guy at first, which I didn't think was justified. And what he was some run of the mill bank robber. He wasn't an MMA mixed, you know, fighter. So I was a little surprised that it was actually that difficult initially. And then,
honestly, considering how it ended, I would have just been like, dude, I give up. Like, it was ugh.
The guy was doing well until he wasn't. So
he really, like, I was like, you can show this on television. Like, he takes the dude's face, and if a bottle is standing up and he crushed his face down on the bottle, which the amount of force you need to do that is a lot. And then after the guy has like glass shards all embedded in his face, he then breaks his leg backwards, which was like, that dude is never walking again. Like, yeah. Ever.
So I can't recall, was he that brutal in the previous series?
He was pretty brutal, but that felt, he has been, but that just felt a little extra.
Well, I mean, but that's been the case this whole season now. He's hurting people.
I think they're bending over backwards to show we're not pulling our punches just because it's on Disney Plus. We are a hard TV MA. This is not for kids.
Let's move on to the other episodes that were actually story-driven continuation of the rest of the story, which is Fisk, or as you like to call him, Malik,
Kingpin.
Kingpin, yes. Kingpin is out in full force, showing his colors, and really kind of being a little bit scary and vindictive and petty.
When the season starts, both of them have abandoned their real selves, pretending to be something they're not. And as the season elapses, both of them return to their true identities, you know, with a vengeance. But in both cases, they are more brutal, more devious, more vengeful, possibly than some of the stuff that, well, I don't know. When Kingpin kills the dude with the car door in season one of the Netflix show, it's like, yeah, oh, man.
That was crazy. But this one, when he goes to the guy that he has locked up and he hands him an axe, nope.
I say you got to go for it. I mean, you're already locked up with a guy who's not right. If he gives you an axe, you got to do what you can. At least you go out swinging, you know?
That's true, literally. But I would have, yeah, but oh, he hurt that dude bad, man.
Yeah.
For me, it felt like the Muse thing, it felt too compressed, like they just crammed it in. Oh, we got to finish this thing. So I wish they had plotted that over more episodes instead of just like
all season long. They've been hinting at this guy and showing little pieces of him, but not giving you any information other than he was dragging bodies. All of a sudden, we reveal he's a graffiti artist. He used to be down with breaking an Electric Boogaloo. I mean, he's like, you know, he's doing all the spray painting with blood. And so you get a lot of story in one episode. I agree. We probably could have at least
data dump. Boom.
Yeah. And yeah. You could have at least. Yeah. Because you find out all that information plus who he is in the same episode. It was too much.
The bridge between 6 and 7 is because he felt her face in the morning. And when he gets to Muse's lair, he can feel the face of the paintings. He know that Muse has his bae. So when he goes to her office, and that's another brutal fight.
Yeah.
Surprise, Muse didn't get thrown out the window except for the police arrived in the proverbial nick of time.
Well, I want to comment on their kind of man on the street interviews that they've been doing throughout the whole season.
Yeah.
They finally kind of started to get interesting to me. And also the acting in them has also gotten really interesting. Like for episode 6, those interviews seem like really real people. I was pretty delighted by it. But they also talked about the swordsman. They have a video clip of someone who's the swordsman.
Oh, right. Yeah.
We then don't hear anything else about. So I imagine that's going to come up in the near future here. But also, we also talked about, you know, both Kingpin and Daredevil kind of going back to their old selves. But Luca goes to Kingpin's office in the main office and tells him, I don't have to listen to you anymore, old man. Now, he knows this guy, right? It's not like he's never met him before. What does he think is going to happen when he says that to him?
All I can say is we find out in episode 7 that Luca gets played by Wilson and Vanessa. Deliciously.
That was nice. Nicely done.
And when I say deliciously, I mean it because he's eating dinner.
I will say in that moment, I wasn't sure who Vanessa was betraying. Because there's a moment where when she's texting and she's like, he's alone eating. And I thought she was telling Fisk that Luca was alone eating, and then you see Fisk alone eating, and I was like, wait, did she betray Luke? I was like, wait, did she betray Fisk? That doesn't make any sense. And then when it happens, you're like, oh, no. Okay, she that was a setup. She set that dude up to show up, and then, yeah.
And the British enforcer took him out.
Yeah, that was... I like that Fisk didn't even stop eating.
Nope.
He just was like, I'm eating my steak. There's a dude trying to shoot me in the back of the head, and I am not worried. Like, he did not even break stride at all. But I thought that Seven ended well in that everybody is fully, like, Matt is fully back in his costume and Fisk is fully back to being Fisk, you know? Mm-hmm. Except now he has the power.
Kingpin.
Thank you. Kingpin is fully back into being Kingpin, but you have to put a Mr. Mayor in front of it. So it's Mr. Mayor Kingpin now. And he's got his secret police force that have to follow his orders. All right. Next up, we're going to talk about adolescence. And the big kick about adolescence is each episode is a one-er. There are no cuts. There are no tricks. They don't have any. They at least say that there are no hidden cuts anywhere.
I probably have some for episode two.
No, I'm telling you, the production has said, the director in production has claimed there are no hidden cuts. That's what they're saying.
That shot at the end of season two, where it becomes an aerial shot.
Episode two.
Well, basically,
it's on a drone. It's like a drone. It's a drone shot.
Yeah, but was it a drone shot completely before that?
Yeah, they have an apparatus where it's a guy on a steady cam, and then it releases into a drone. It releases into a drone. Yeah, they have all the behind the scenes stuff. But interesting. So that's the shtick. They spend weeks rehearsing the whole thing, doing rehearsals.
I mean, there's a shot where they leave a classroom, and I think I heard what they did was the window is CG. So the kid goes out the window. The camera is one take, but that window's not there because it can't be. So technically it is one shot.
Jackie Chan could do it, Peter.
But every show has VFX. That's not the question. Are they hiding cuts? But the overall premise of the show, which I think is an interesting topic, which is called adolescence, is a 13-year-old boy who has killed one of his classmates.
Allegedly. Thing,
We saw the video.
Allegedly, he has not been convicted in a court of law.
Oh, true. He has not been convicted. That is true.
I'm saying is that opening scene where they send 20 cops to arrest a 13-year-old boy, I felt was just overkill. A tad excessive. I was like, is he a drug dealer? But it was just a lot of cops to arrest this kid. I was like, wow, what is going on?
I wish episode one had been stronger. It didn't need to be supersized because they let it drag till we find out what's going on. And I just wish, get to it, because we know the premise of the show.
I was okay with it. I mean, it probably could have been trimmed a little. I think the second episode is tighter. Like, they have more to do because they're on the school grounds. But I see what you're saying, but I didn't finish the episode and was like, this is terrible, I'm out. It's a little bloated, but I mean, like, it's not that big of a deal to me.
I just wish that they had made that first episode tighter because,
they couldn't make it tighter because they couldn't cut. That's actually the problem.
Hold on, roll with me for a moment, Peter.
So I liked the concept of the show. I thought the actors are brilliant all the way across. I didn't actually, that one take concept is a concept. It was not, particularly for the pilot, it was not necessary to help further our understanding of the story. And there were places where it actually hindered that because you knew they were vamping. They were vamping because they had to get the camera from one place to another. And I felt that more in episode one than I did in episode two. So I think they may have learned from episode one. Yeah. So for me, it was slow because they couldn't cut. And they had a few moments of vamping while I had to get, you know, get somebody to the next spot. But it didn't, to me, it didn't overshadow one, the father's, the father of the accused. His work was so full, so vibrant, so nuanced. He was, to me, he was really the star of the pilot. And then the kid.
I felt for him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the kid and the detective as well, the main detective, all did some really strong work.
I will say before we dive into the show, as long as we're talking about the fact that it's in the industry a one-er or whatever, is that Apple has a show called The Studio and the second episode is a one-er. And I thought, and that's a comedy, but one of the things I thought the second episode did really well, I watched Adolescence first, was that we don't realize when we're watching Adolescence how much stuff is going on behind the scenes that could mess up the take. Something could fall, like door might not open right, or a person's having a conversation. And so like watching those two within days of each other, that was actually kind of interesting for me. It made me respect how well Adolescence is, even though I agree with Tom that, and Emily, that it's like they are kind of vamping and it probably could have been tighter, but still it's pretty impressive. Like, yeah. Also, because it's in a one-er, that means these four episodes are essentially Jack Bauer 24, right?
Yes, all real time.
They're essentially real time. That's the idea, right? Yeah. You can't be like 3 months later. It's like, well, I mean, I guess you could from episode, but you know what I mean? You can't be like later that night. It's like, no, this is all happening right now. I've been to a lot of like government things. Things take forever. So in the pilot, there's a moment where they're like, it's 6:20. He was arrested. It is now 6:55. I'm like, really? That quickly? If anything, I think in real life, it would take hours to actually get to the scene where they're actually going to show the tape. I think in real life, it would take like the whole day. Whereas in this, they're like, well, that's a really quick 40 minutes that it all got. That's what I was thinking just because of government red tape and everything. Again, you're right. It's England. It is not how we do things, but I just thought, wow, they are really efficient there. Like,
so. Well, that's another interesting thing you bring up, Peter. I think a couple of people have mentioned this. So it is Britain. It is their policing system and what we're accustomed to in terms of what rights you have. And there are lots of moments in both episodes where I'm like, can they do that? Can the police do that?
I know. I was thinking the same thing. They took his blood and his DNA and they were like, the only time where he got to say no was opening his phone. But other than he didn't get to say no for anything.
And
Even our version of, you know, the right to remain silent, they added on, but if you refuse to answer, it can hurt your case. I was like, what? It's just also, it's just different because it's not our system of law.
Second episode, the moment for me was the black girl,
Jade,
going after the kid. And it's interesting because the cop was smart enough to figure out that didn't just happen out of the blue. So you can see the wheels turning. We've got to find out why she went after this kid and then interrogate him.
So we started talking about like what's different between US and British law. And I was astounded that the police are just walking through a school, talking to kids, interrogating them without any opportunity to call their parents. And the only time, one time he asks when somebody's slightly resistant, oh, do you want me to call somebody? But it's like, y'all police can just walk through your schools like that and talk to kids? That blew my mind. But Jade, just like I said, the father of the accused was my favorite character in episode one. Jade was by far my favorite character in episode two. Because it wasn't just when she got into the fight, even earlier than that, when she was being interrogated the first time. Mm-hmm. She has such a mix. I mean, she has the anger, but she has this vulnerability. She is both wise and naive at the same time. I loved her so much that my only problem with the one-er in this episode was when they had the camera on the detective's face when she was talking. I was like, get the camera back on her face. She was my favorite character. She did such a wonderful job.
I really liked, I agree with you. She probably is the highlight. But I got to say, the detective's son essentially is a exposition dump, right? He's basically one to be like, you're looking at this wrong, and I'm a teenager. I will tell you what these emojis are. I thought he was really good, even though really technically all he's doing is giving you exposition.
Oh, more Peter.
No, because it was also about the relationship between the father and son.
But he's the one who gives us the info thing of like, this is what this means, but he does it in a very compelling way. And of course, it's even more dynamic because it's a father and son relationship. I really liked that.
Yeah, so they had a great way. I mean, we always, how do you do exposition, right? The best way is that it doesn't sound like exposition. So you're right on that. The exposition is at the crux of the father-son relationship, which is actually the heart of character and story here. Right. And he gets to deliver that exposition. But that father-son relationship is so full.
Good.
And you can see that we have seen the detective DCI, right? That's what I call it.
Inspector DI.
I thought he had three letters.
No, okay.
There were three letters.
But we saw the detective work with the accused, work with all the other kids, keeping them calm, keeping them easy. And when he talks to his son, it's like he's got blind spots all over the place. He doesn't know how to talk to him. They're clearly uncomfortable with each other, which makes it so interesting to watch.
And you just know that he has spent way more time on the job than at home.
Than with his son.
And now it's like, oh, now you want to talk to me? Now that there's a murder at my school?
And then his son says, you don't call me son. You call other people son. You never call me that. It's like you're talking to me like them. And I thought, oh my goodness, that's so.
Yeah. Ooh. Next up, we're going to talk about The Residence, and we're going to talk episodes 1 and 2. And
you mean
this
only
show...
murders in the White House?
That is correct. And instead of Steve Martin and Martin Short, we get
Uzo Aduba.
Thank you. I was pausing on her name because I didn't want to mess it up. I appreciate that. But her character is kind of an eclectic mix of a couple of different characters, and they name drop all these other characters who are supposed to be
Daniel Craig. Best
detective in the world. And of course she has to have a thing that makes her quirky, which is her obsession with birds and how that relates to the case. And even though I knew all of this, I still found her interesting and compelling. And my favorite thing is when she walked in and she goes, why are there so many men here? What's with all the men?
Yeah,
and she's like, why are you all standing around? What are you doing? So I thought that was just an interesting take, and I got excited to see Giancarlo Esposito, and then he was immediately dead. You know,
flashbacks. But I mean, Yeah.
It's the same thing as Paul Rudd got immediately killed in Only Murders, but he's in the whole season. So same idea. And you're going through it, trying to figure out who did it, who done it. And of course you have a couple. The only thing is the guy who's the advisor to the president, who's like the president's best friend,
is the actor's name.
Yeah. He was exceptionally annoying, but I think he's supposed to be.
I still think acting wise, if I was the director, I'd be like, let's take that down 10%. Like I was looking
here.
I love that act. He's a terrific comedic actor, but I was like, oh man, you're really playing this broad. Like
Peter, I might go for 15%.
Do I hear 20%?
Yeah,
20%?
Yeah. I agree.
You know, what's interesting is this is the third murder-based series, and there are some things I like better about this, and there's some things I don't like quite as good.
Third of what?
Well, Paradise.
What are the third?
Oh, comedies. I'm thinking the After Party and Only Murders.
Okay.
I kind of miss having a strong ensemble working together, but I do like Uzo Aduba as my black female detective better than
others. She's great.
I did like, what's the singer's name? Oh my God, I've just blanked off.
Kylie Minogue.
Yeah, I did like just having Kylie Minogue, and I liked in the second episode she gets questioned. Like I thought that was great.
And then she had to sing her hit song seven times. And
I like that she wasn't even supposed to sing; she was just a guest.
Right.
She was just supposed to come and have dinner, and next thing you know, she's on stage singing.
After we have the first episode of Hijinks, and they're trying to get the president to shut down, you know, basically seal off the White House. And he's like, absolutely not, absolutely not. And then she's staring at the Australian ambassador and figures out
with binoculars. With binoculars.
It's like, why are you wearing a dead man's shirt? And the president's like, shut it down.
That was a good cliffhanger.
Because then I was like,
oh yeah, I got to watch the next one.
So since we're making a comparison to Only Murders in the Building, that show largely flourished on the fact that you had comedic geniuses in the main cast, particularly Steve Martin and Martin Short. This show thrives, one, because of the storytelling, and two, because of the phenomenal actors who deal with comedy well. So the show doesn't rely on them being comic geniuses, but the show writes really good stuff for them, and they handle it so well. Mm-hmm. Uzo's relationship with Randall Park is one of the most refreshing things on television right now. The way they collaborate and fight, but still are kind of on the same page.
I really like that he kept trying to help her, and she kept saying, "Go away, I don't need you." And he was like, she's like, "You can just stay right here." He goes, "Oh, okay." And then next thing you know, he's getting in the elevator. Right. Like, you know, he's just following her around. And he genuinely, I think, wants to help. At least by episode two, that was my impression.
I think the problem I had in the second episode is more knowing that, like, it's kind of funny. We just talked about adolescence, and Tom was like, well, it's only four episodes. I'm a little nervous that this is, I've heard this is good. I'm a little nervous that this is stretched out to, is it 8 or 10?
It's 8.
Am I that interested, like, for 8 episodes about this? Like, also, we were just talking about Ken Marino. I thought the same thing, how the opening of episode 2, after we do, there's an eagle, right? The eagle kind of, like, is seeing all the grounds of the White House and everything. The big opening scene is with the chef, right?
Right.
I kind of thought Marvella, her performance was also dialed up to 11, where I was like, what is the deal? Like, why are we doing these openings with these one character that's like, so I will kill you. And I was like, okay. Like, later the character explains that why she had sex with is it the prime minister? Or is the prime minister's assistant?
It was like the deputy prime minister or something.
Right. But she later says, like, I just had to get that energy out. So that it sort of justifies why she's so amped up in that opening. But for me, I was just like, okay, take it down. Like, and she's, also, I thought the second episode was a little weaker because Uzo, while she's in it, because she's interviewing everybody, she is kind of a passive character where she's basically being able to get to interview all these people. And so I was like, well, what I like about the show is really her. So it makes me worry that if you're extending this for 8 episodes, that we're not going to get we don't get to utilize her as much, or you have to like stretch it thin.
I've watched ahead. Now, I can't guarantee that you will be satisfied, Peter, but I've absolutely been satisfied with what I've watched so far.
Well, do you think she gets to do more?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd also just wanted to say one more thing about the premise, which is that we go back and forward in time, right? There's this Senate hearing that's happening after the facts of that night. And I like how the show goes back and forth. It has a former actor who was a former senator now playing a senator. And also it allows the story to talk to itself and reveal story in some pretty compelling ways. I really like that structure.
I was skeptical when I thought, oh, another murder mystery comedy with an all-star cast. And then Uzo Aduba and Giancarlo Esposito. And I'm like, okay, I'm in. And Susan Kalichi Watson from This Is Us. Love her.
Oh, right. Who actually has a pretty big motive to kill him, by the way, which everybody's ignoring at the moment. But I will be disappointed if she's actually the killer, because she's the most obvious person to be the killer.
Plus, the butler did it? Come on, really?
So I think we're saying overall thumbs up for Residents. We're going to be covering that again. Next up, we're going to talk Wheel of Time, episodes 4 through 6. And each episode of Wheel of Time is at least an hour. if not an hour and 6 minutes, which talk about trimming stuff down. I do feel these episodes are just a tad too long. So what I really liked in episode 4 was Rand and Moraine are doing, they're going through this test. One of them gets to see the past of all his... Yes, they're going to see the past of all their his ancestors. So Rand does all these flashbacks up to 3,000 years in his past to see all his ancestors. And I found his story to be extremely compelling. Moraine got to see, like, you know, in the multiverse with Doctor Strange, where he got to see 7 million outcomes.
Right.
She basically, and she's like, only one of them do we get victory. She right. basically did the same thing where she saw 10,000 versions of her future. And half of them, either Rand died or she died. And we got to watch them both die a lot in her visions. But yeah. with Rand, I really loved finding out that the Aiel warrior race that we've always known as these great fighters come from a race of people who were always about peace. And they had sworn a vow to never pick up a sword and to always be peaceful.
And even those in self-defense.
Even in self-defense. And those people were originally called the Aiel, but they had two people who broke their vow. And those people ended up co-opting the name of Aiel and became these great warriors. And that's why people started calling them Oathbreakers.
And the original ones became the Tinkers.
Yes. And so I was like, that was fantastic. That was just really good.
The reason why Rand went through that thing to see his ancestors so that he could become the Karakhan, the king right. of kings, basically, chief of chiefs. And the Aiel have a prophecy that this Karakhan will destroy them so that some of them can live. Can you imagine right. a prophecy was like, we're waiting for the person who's going to destroy all of us so a few of us can survive, because I guess if he doesn't come, all of them will become will be destroyed. So correct. That's just a lot to sit with, I think, as a people. Also up top near that episode, there was a moment where Lan and Avienda are fighting. And I swear, Livia, this was before we rewatched The Matrix. I watched that and I was like, Morpheus and Neo are fighting. Like
it was a good fight. It was a really good fight.
Like to me.
What was heartbreaking about that, after she did so well in that fight, they're like, now we're going to take your spears, and they literally break them.
Yes.
And you will like, never pick up that? You will never pick up a spear again in your life. And I was like, but what? She's so good. Why?
Y'all could have re-gifted it or something. Why you got to break it? You know what I'm saying?
Recycle.
Yeah, that was heartbreaking. That hurt my feelings.
So. Yeah. And then there's just another moment when they, you know, they're trying to get permission to go into Ruadin, and Kuladin is trying to interfere. And the wise one is like, put on a dress and come to me to be trained. Otherwise, hold your tongue when wise ones are talking. I wanted to go hide somewhere on his behalf when she said that to him. That was pretty
good. I wasn't wild about it. I don't know. It just felt like big expository dump for me. That's the dude in a bunch of wigs. Yeah.
So what did you think of the next episode?
Some of the makeup was a little bit better than some of the old makeup was a little dicey.
It was okay. It's like, it was okay.
Y'all need better makeup artists.
For me, episode 5, I actually used the word world building in my notes that I wrote about that episode.
Okay.
It was just nice. So in terms of the story, I wasn't wowed by 5, but in terms of some of the details that they provided to us, like they had the Aiel behaving like Muslims. They only eat with their right hand. You don't eat with your left hand. And just to have a moment like that where they reveal that aspect of their culture, I thought somebody's paying attention here.
It also reminded me of the Fremen. I was like, these guys feel like the Fremen to me.
The dude with the black dude with the skunk hair.
Oh, and the white cloaks.
The white cloaks. They come back with a vengeance, and and the long haired dude saves them. Oh, the warder for
What's her name? Ariel. She's the green Aja.
Alana. She's getting turned into a human pincushion, and then she had earlier separated her. She and the warder have a big fight, and he kind of storms off, and then he comes back in the heat of battle to save her. And he's like, but I severed my bond. And he's like, yeah, you reactivated about 12
about five arrows in. Yeah.
Five arrows ago.
Warders have exactly one job.
To protect their
one job is to protect their Aes Sedai from being attacked. So her warder says, you're about to start a fight against people who specialize in killing Aes Sedai. And I'm going to take this moment to beef with you and tell you I'm going to leave. Not only that, he actually can't leave unless she releases him. So he's talking all big, like he's made this decision, I'm leaving. And then she says, oh yes, I released your bond. He wasn't going nowhere unless she released his bond. So that's why I say that moment was problematic.
It seemed to me like brinkmanship. It's like, you're making a really big mistake. And if I could leave you, I will. Oh, yeah? I'm going to release you. Well, I'm leaving. And then he comes back.
The scene with Rand and Egwene, I called 3 or 4 episodes ago that he was going to get caught in the moment we found dream. Out she was a dreamwalker, I was like, okay, countdown to when Rand is going to get caught making out with Lanfear in the dream. And to be fair to Rand, he didn't know that Lanfear was screwing with Egwene's memories. So he doesn't know that. Wait. That's the little bit I'm giving him. I'm giving him that bit. But he did know that he was cheating on Egwene by having sex with Lanfear in his dreams. He knows that.
Wait, it's a dream, right? It's not real.
No, but it is real. No, because for the Forsaken,
you're calling it a dream.
No, but it's a dream world. When Rand is asleep, Lanfear can enter his dreams and interact with him, share information with him, communicate with him. So he knows she's real. He knows she's really there talking to him. It's
and
not
he's
just
going to meet her. She yes. isn't just walking up on him. They are meeting at a particular place.
He's right. literally having an affair.
In his dreams, in the dream world. And he's sleeping with his girlfriend right next to him. So,
hold on, Libya. Whatever credit you want to give to Rand, there's a reason they are called the Forsaken. You're not supposed to be having an affair with the Forsaken.
All these things are true. Regardless of the cheating on her, he's supposed to be a good guy. He's yes. supposed to be trying to start the Dark One. So having an affair with the Forsaken, who is the lieutenant of the Dark One, all of those things are wrong.
If we've learned nothing else from 3 seasons of the show, he may be pretty, but he ain't smart.
Mm-mm. No, he is not. And whatever, you know, he deserved all the things that Egwene served on him. So Matt and Min and Nynaeve, Elaine, all of them are looking
for the collar, but they find the bracelet.
Right, but they're also looking for Leandrin.
They give you her backstory, and you can actually see why she became a dark friend, because the light abandoned her. She was in an abusive situation, had a little baby, and nobody would help her. The only mm-hmm. person who would help her is one of the Forsaken. So mm-hmm. I kind of don't blame her. Here's my question. Why is Moraine still in cahoots with Lanfear? She's meeting with her. She's sharing information with her. She's plotting with her. Lanfear said, I'm going to send a little surprise out to Rand. I need you to not do anything. She is actively collaborating with Lanfear. This is one of the things that is different from the book.
And a lot. I loved Moraine before, and now I don't trust her.
I don't trust her either, because she's, you know, her job is to help Rand, but she also likes to take care of number one.
Her job is to save the world. Whether that includes, like, that, she's looking at
the big picture.
She's looking at big picture, and whatever it takes to get to that big picture, that's what she's doing.
The scene of this episode is when Mogideon goes to Nynaeve and Elaine, and she basically dispels them. Mm-hmm. And then they get all agreeable, and they're giddy and happy, and she's talking to them. And then Nynaeve still resists her, even under the spell.
Is that why she cut her?
Maybe to give her a reminder.
I thought it was interesting because they realize that when they're unbewitched, de-bewitched, that it's gone, and there's this big old gash on her face, and they realize we've been had.
Rand is basically trying to gaslight Egwene. Mm-hmm. She's like, I saw you in a dream world with that Forsaken. He's like, oh, well, that's because I knew you never wanted me. Yeah, that's it. and I was never going to be enough. Yeah, that's it. Like, I'm like, man, how are you going to try to gaslight this woman and just because she caught you with one of the Forsaken? So, but then it occurred to me that maybe he was trying to break up with her because he knows that there's a lot of versions of the world where he kills her. Right. So it's possible that he actually was being a gaslighter in order to try to save her. I hope that's it. Otherwise, I don't really like that dude that much. We'll find out.
When the end of, at the very beginning of the episode where he's with the swordswomen and the little girl's got the big sword and they bond and whatnot, I'm like, okay, the rules declare that kid is toast. Fast forward to the end of the episode when the big battle breaks out and there is a corpse in the middle of them and he's like convinced he has the power of life and death. It's like, nah, dog, you are trying to, your ego's writing checks, your powers can't cash.
Well, it's really the madness, right? It's always said that a man who channels will go mad. It's not a matter of if, but when.
And so it's all about how much you channel. How much you channel turn. Yeah, that decides it.
Who was the guy in Game of Thrones who had the flaming swords? Was that me?
Oh, it was the guy, Dondarrion, with the eye patch.
Beric Dondarrion?
Beric Dondarrion, yeah.
So Avienda came in like him at the end of that scene when Ravin attacked. She channeled two flaming swords. I was like,
that was awesome. Go, girl.
But also Rand beat him without looking at him. Did you peep that? He had ran out of the house. He started channeling. And then he just like did like this. And Ravin was behind him. And he brought the whole house down without even turning to look at him. I was like, man, look, Ma, no hands. It was nice.
This season has been remarkable. I think they are doing a great job. Like I said, the only thing is I feel like they should make a couple of trims because each episode doesn't need to be over an hour. It feels a little indulgent that the episodes are that long. So other than that, though, I love where they're going with the story. I pretty much love every character. The only thing that is kind of making me mad is Moraine used to be my favorite character in all the books. And now they're making me doubt her. And she's not really my favorite now because I can't trust her, you know? And I think they're doing it to make her more interesting, but is it more interesting? All right, so we're giving it thumbs up, right?
Later. Bye.